Okay, well, I'm going to say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and I've got two great guests lined up today who have just completed a book called Petrus Romanus. And first is Thomas Horn, an internationally recognized lecturer and best-selling author of several books, including his newest books, Petrus Romanus, Forbidden Gates, and Apollyon Rising, 2012. He's a well-known columnist whose articles have been referred to by writers of the LA Times Syndicate, MSNBC, Christianity Today, New Man Magazine, WorldNet Daily, Newsmax, White House Correspondents, and dozens of news magazines and press agencies around the globe. He's been interviewed by U.S. congressmen and senators on his findings, as well as featured repeatedly in major media, including the top 10 talk shows, America's Morning News for the Washington Times, the 700 Club, the Harvest Show, Coast to Coast AM, Prophecy in the News, and the Southwest Radio Church, to name a few. Thomas received the highest degree, honorary doctorate bestowed in 2007 from legendary professor Dr. I.D.E. Thomas for his research into ancient history, and has been endorsed by such national leaders as Dr. James Kennedy. And my other guest is Chris Putnam, and his Logos Apology is the ministry of Christy Putnam, and Chris has a Master of Arts degree in Theological Studies and a Bachelor of Science in Religion and Mathematics. He's a member of Providence Baptist Church and International Society of Christian Apologetics, the Evangelical Philosophical Society, and the Tau Sigma National Honor Society. The mission of Logos Apologia is to show that logic, science, history, and faith are complementary, not contradictory, and to bring that life-changing truth to everybody who wants to know. The calling is twofold: apologetics, the branch of theology that is concerned with defending and proving the truth of Christian doctrines, formal argumentation in defense of something, such as a position or system. Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready. Well, that was a gospel here. And then the other part of it is polemics, the branch of Christian theology devoted to the refutation of errors, the practice of disputing and controverting significant broad-reaching topics of magnitude, such as religious, philosophical, political, and scientific matters. Now, gentlemen, I'm going to, whoever wants to go first, but I'd like you to, if there's anything you'd like to add to this, please do so. And these aren't just your areas you cover a wide range of subjects in your areas of expertise. I can tell by listening to a number of your interviews and looking at your websites and writings. And while we're at it, I don't know that I gave your websites, did I? I think we've got Raiders News Update, right, Tom?
Yes, RaidersNewsUpdate.com.
And yours is logosapologia.org, is that
right? That's correct. Yeah, it's logos and then APOLOGIA.org, logosapologia.org, and that's for Chris Putnam.
Okay. Who would like to start first?
Well, I mean, I can get us kick-started, and I can also let you know that, you know, people listening to those bios, if they listened between the lines, they would come to understand that basically I'm a media blowhard, and the real academic on this show today is Chris Putnam. The very reason why Chris was involved in this latest research, Petrus Romanus, the Final Pope is Here, is because he does bring academic credentials. He is an apologist. He is a theologian. And I've had respect for Chris for some time. And when people read the book, they're obviously going to be aware of those chapters that were written by him, because they are excellent, each one of them kind of a mini treatise on certain ideas and concepts. In fact, in my opinion, the best parts of the book were those that were written by Chris. So it's wonderful to be on the show with him today.
Now, with the Petrus Romanus, this was kind of a different direction than I'd seen that I'd been following you a little bit, and do you want to get into why you did this and what it's all about?
Sure. It's actually kind of an interesting story that I won't add a great deal of detail to. People that have read my book before this one, Apollyon Rising 2012, would find that there's only one paragraph in that whole book that refers to the prophecy of the popes. And because it is an extra-biblical prophecy, I only ever, you know, gave it a limited amount of my attention, and even then only because it seemed to be playing out to be fulfilled in the year 2012, which a lot of other ancient societies and writers and thinkers also seem to look forward to as kind of an event horizon for prophecy. So I'd only mentioned it in that book. But then what happened was last year, I'd been thinking again about the prophecy of the popes and how you have this medieval prophecy that may be, you know, it may be 900 or more years old, and the pope to be elected that will follow Benedict XVI, the current pope, is the last one on this list. So in that sense, it is historic, regardless of what you make of it, whether you think it's a fraud, whether you think it's real, whether you think it's divinely inspired, demonically inspired, whatever you might think of it. It is a very old prophecy that will be fulfilled very soon. And last year, I was speaking at a conference in Idaho. I was speaking at Chuck Missler's Strategic Perspectives Conference, and I had my staff with me, and we were talking about the prophecy of the popes. And at the time, there was some news media that was alleging that Pope Benedict might retire on his birthday, which was just this last month in April. And then there were other news accounts, and some of these being published by some of the official voices, like the, I can't even say the name of it, but the official Vatican newspaper. And it was talking about how Pope Benedict is getting old. He's being wheeled around on carts everywhere he's going right now. He needs to basically be carried upstairs, so he's aged, and not doing very well in terms of his health right now. So there was some speculation that he was going to retire in 2012. Well, when he does, and he still certainly could this year, 2012. In fact, his brother, who's a Catholic priest, is encouraging him to retire right now. And Benedict, who is a theologian for the church, has argued in his own book that if a pope gets to the point where he can't carry out his duties, it would be okay in terms of Catholic dogma for him to step aside and let somebody fill his shoes. So all this stuff was in the news, and I got to thinking about the prophecy of the popes, was talking to my staff about it, and I said, you know, I'm amazed that nobody has written a current book on the fact that you have this very old prophecy about to be fulfilled in the successor to Pope Benedict XVI. And we were talking about it, and I went to my hotel room, and out of the blue was an email from Chris Putnam. And he was asking me if it was okay for him to use that one paragraph that was in Apollyon Rising 2012 on the prophecy of the popes. And so I emailed him back, and I said, Chris, I said, man, the timing of this is crazy in that I've been talking about this all day with my staff. Anyway, make a long story short, things went back and forth. We both agreed that the timing of this was now, and over some weeks corresponding and talking to one another, we decided to work on this book project together. And once we started working on the project, and Chris can fill in some of these lines, but there was stuff that started falling into our laps that was quite amazing, and in fact, there was more than one time where I think we both stopped and paused and wondered if we even should write this book, because some of the stuff that we came across would make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. And ultimately, of course, we decided to go ahead and write the book, and you know, it's been the number one book in its genre at Amazon for something like 6 weeks before it was even in print. So the book is out there, and of course we expect when Pope Benedict does step down, or some believe he'll be assassinated or die or whatever, if that happens in 2012, I expect this book's probably going to zenith into the stratosphere.
And Chris?
Well, first of all, Tom, thank you very much for those kind words, and I really appreciate that. It means a lot coming from somebody with your experience and background in the industry. I had first hooked up with Tom through his interest in transhumanism and his writings on that. He wrote a letter to Christian leaders that the time was running out to respond to this issue of transhumanism as Congress is making decisions and things are happening. And I responded to that letter, and actually I was in seminary at the time, and I wrote a paper for a theology course that Tom ended up publishing in the book Pandemonium's Engine. So we had a relationship from that, and you know, Tom would link to a lot of my articles that I put up on my blog at his Raiders News site over the last couple of years. And we started talking about the prophecy of the popes and, how it could potentially come into play in the biblical prophecy. You know, and the thing that's interesting, and if any of your listeners, aren't really aware of what we're talking about, this guy, St. Malachi, allegedly, in 1139 A.D., prophesied 112 popes to the end of time. So this is like 900 years ago, and he prophesies a list of these Latin phrases to represent the pontificate of 112 popes. Well, the thing that's very interesting, especially from a Protestant perspective, is that the last pope has this little apocalyptic paragraph, and I'll just read it so everyone will know what we're talking about here. This is how the prophecy of the popes ends. In the extreme persecution of the Holy Roman Church, there will sit Peter the Roman, who will nurse the sheep in many tribulations. When they are finished, the city of seven hills will be destroyed, and the dreadful judge will judge his people. The end. Now, if you're familiar with the book of Revelation and you study end time prophecy, that a few things jump out at you right away from that little ending. The city of seven hills is mentioned specifically in the book of Revelation, referring to Mystery Babylon. Specifically, if you look at Revelation chapter 17, verse 9, it reads that, "And here's the mind which has wisdom, the seven heads or seven mountains on which the woman sitteth." And the woman, of course, being the great harlot, Mystery Babylon the Great, in the book of Revelation, representing apostate religion. And, throughout the Reformation up until, now, many scholars have seen the Roman Church as that figure. And, it's not necessarily only the Roman Church, because a good deal of Protestantism is apostate these days as well. You can look at a lot of the decisions being made in the mainline denominations, and it's just not hard at all to see that they've gone away from biblical truth. When we see this in the prophecy of the popes, that really kind of attracts your attention that perhaps there is a coherence between the ending of this and what the book of Revelation describes in the tribulation period. And from there, we started digging in to see what we could dig up. And, there's a lot of scholarship out there that will say that this prophecy is a forgery, that it was manufactured in the 16th century. But I did a lot of investigation, and there's a lot in the book about this, and we can talk about it, if you like, about authenticity and the origins of it. But when I set out to investigate it, I did a pretty thorough job, and I determined that, I can't say for sure that this thing is going to happen the way it all is predicted, but there's too much to it to brush it aside, and there's some supernatural aspects of it that just can't be explained away. But the more that Tom and I dug in, the more we discovered, and there's just a lot of interesting intersections with this prophecy and in recent history as well. But there's just way too much going on to dismiss it. We're not going to say that it's going to happen in 2012 for sure, but it sure does look like it's fallen in place.
So,
let me add to what Chris is saying. One thing I learned about Chris, and I've referred to him tongue in cheek this way ever since in other media as well. This guy is a bloodhound. And I mean that seriously. He is a fantastic researcher. He dug up information that I couldn't have dreamed of finding. And Protestants that are listening to this show will be glad to know that, first of all, Chris and I both are biblical literalists. We believe in the inspired Word of God. We do not believe that extra-biblical prophecy is ever to be compared to or put on a par with the authority of the Bible. And after studying the history of the prophecy of the popes and all of the surrounding scholarly literature, Chris came to some I think, rock-solid conclusions. First of all, that part of the prophecy might be a forgery that was actually fabricated in the late 16th century, and this had to do with a cardinal by the name of Simon Selle that somebody in the 1500s may have been trying to promote as the cardinal who should be elected the pope. Now, it raises a lot of questions. First of all, if that's true, it implies that the cardinals, who at that time were the only ones who had eyes on this ancient prophecy. It was hidden away in the Vatican for 500 years or so, it was actually not even brought into the light of day until one of the Vatican's Benedictine historians, a guy by the name of Arnold de Wyon, published it in a very large book that he wrote called Lignum Vitae, which means the Tree of Life. But before that, it was hidden in the Vatican's archives. And if the legend that Chris writes about in one of the chapters, one of the early chapters in the book Petrus Romanus, if the legend is true, then what happened was somebody, knowing that the cardinals were putting a lot of stock in this prophecy, altered the prophecy to try to get them to elect this Simon Selle as the pope. Well, that didn't work, and there was another guy that was voted in as the pope. But here's the interesting part about this prophecy. If, in fact, it was a forgery from 1595 and forward when it was published into English, when it was published for public review, you would have thought that this prophecy would fall completely apart. In other words, the part before 1595 could have been Vaticinia ex eventu, or prophecy from the event, meaning somebody looking backward, creating the prophecy, could have very easily just filled in the lines about the popes who would have been elected and made it look like this is an old document that had pre-forecast all these popes, but that from 1595 forward, after it was published, you would expect the prophecy to fall completely apart, to be completely inaccurate. And the strange thing about this prophecy is that from 1595 and forward, it takes on an entirely different kind of feeling, and there were times when it is startlingly accurate. In fact, some experts believe it's gotten even more accurate as time has moved forward. Now, if our whole book was only about the prophecy of the popes, and there are biblical experts out there right now that are saying that our book is the best examination, the most thorough treatment of the prophecy of the popes ever written. And that probably is true. But if that was all this book was about, I wouldn't have been interested in writing it. What interested me was, first, the historical fact that you have an ancient prophecy that is due to come to pass now. It looks like it's going to come to pass in the year 2012. And when that is coupled with so many other kinds of biblical prophetic events that are unfolding in the world around us, and then thirdly, add to that how many ancient writers, from hundreds of years ago, Christian writers, to thousands of years ago, occultic societies, looking forward down through time to the year 2012 as a specific moment in time in which several things would happen. Number one, that there would be distress among the nations. Number two, that it would be witnessed by the return of their deity figure. And there's a common theme among many of the ancient occultic societies that looked forward to 2012 as the year in which their great dragon, who has the power of air, a flying dragon, would return in the year 2012. So when you take all of the things that we're talking about in this book and you put it together, it very much feels like something supernatural is happening. And going back to being biblical literalists, we do believe in end times prophecy. We believe that Matthew 24 and comparable places in Scripture set forth certain events that we could watch for that would unfold in the world at a time that would tell us that the false prophet of biblical fame is about to appear and that the Antichrist is about to appear. And that is exactly where this 900-year-old Catholic prophecy falls, because according to Malachi, Olmorgair, or whoever the actual author of the document was, this will be the final pope. This will be the last one, and he will be the one who will be the pope during the time of the Great Tribulation period. He will help, he will be a pope under the control of Satan. He will help give rise to the Antichrist. Well, that very much does seem like something that is emerging as complementary to all of the other things that are unfolding in prophecy around the world right now. And so all of this sort of demanded, since nobody else was doing it, since nobody else was paying attention to how what could be the most important aspects of end times biblical prophecy in our lifetime is unfolding, nobody else was doing it, so Chris Putnam and I took it on. And people might want... what's interesting, Melody and Chris, is as I'm doing these radio shows, I'm getting two kinds of response. I just did a show just before I came on this one out of Ireland. And, of course, Ireland, you know, this is the home of Malachi Olmorgair. So this was a very interesting drive time show I did over there. But I'm getting two different responses. There are those who are saying, glory, hallelujah. I mean, they're looking at this. And they sense out of this research that the appearing of Jesus Christ is imminent, and that is their blessed hope. But I got to tell you, there's others that this is scaring the you know what out of them, because the more you look into this research, if you read the book Petrus Romanus, your hair is going to stand on end. There, way too much than we can talk about in a radio show. This book is almost 600 pages long. Wow. In an oversized book cover. There's over 700 authoritative endnotes, images, charts that are created in the book. Let me just say that if you're an ostrich Christian and you prefer keeping your head in the sand, don't read Petrus Romanus, because it's going to wake you up and it's going to scare you. And if it does scare you, hopefully it scares the Hades out of you, because that's exactly what we hope to do.
So did you get anybody saying that this may be a predictive, that the world rulers are trying to follow these predictions and help them to come to be?
Well, let me quickly answer that, and then I'll turn it over to Chris. It raises a very interesting question. We can talk about the accuracy of some of these prophecies that lead you, and I especially want Chris to talk about the French Codex that was written by a French Jesuit by the name of René Thibault. But when you look at this evidence, you come to a conclusion that there is something about this prophecy. Either that it was divinely inspired, or that it was demonically inspired, or there's a third option, and that is that the College of Cardinals, the cardinals that elect the popes, have been following this prophecy like a roadmap, and that they are in particular choosing successors to sit on the throne of Peter, that they believe in one way or another can match up to the prophecy of the popes. Now, there are reasons why I think that third option is strained. Even though it would play very well into the hands of conspiracy theories, there's reasons we can talk about and Chris can talk about that have to do with heraldry and what it requires to put your heraldry in place, how sometimes that's as many as 40 years ahead of the time you might be elected as a pope, that make it mathematically improbable that anybody would be able to handpick an electable, a papable cardinal at a particular time whose heraldry would just, you know, happen to coincidentally match the prophecies as they have been stated in the prophecy of the Pope. So there is some questions around this, though, whether the cardinals are electing popes that match the prophecy, or whether the prophecy was in fact either divinely or demonically inspired. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Chris.
That's fine. That's fine. You know, I think of the three options that Tom just listed, that we can see evidence of all three. Now, you know, when I first set out to investigate this thing, just like Tom said, I believe in biblical prophecy, and I believe that that's how we can tell that the Bible is inspired by God, is that we can see that it writes the future in advance, and you can prove that to yourself if you study biblical prophecy. But, you know, I didn't really have any reason to accept that this alleged prophecy by Malachi was authentic by its own merits. You know, it had to kind of prove itself to me. And when I first started investigating it, it didn't look good, because a lot of the Jesuits out there have written very critical books, you know, mentioning the conspiracy to elect Simon Selle that Tom talked about as evidence that the whole thing was a forgery. But there's some problems with that line of reasoning. If you think about it, if these Catholics were cooking up a prophecy to get a certain guy elected pope in the 16th century, why would they bother to include 112 on the list and then forecast the destruction of Rome? That right there is a huge problem for that conspiracy theory, because, I mean, number one, they're Catholics. They have a vested interest in Rome not being destroyed. And, you know, they're trying to get a pope elected. It just doesn't make sense that they would create such a fraud and then, you know, and do something that's against their own self-interest in prophesying that. Now, it would make sense to me that Jesuits would want to discredit this prophecy, because it seems to forecast the destruction of Rome and the judgment of the Catholic Church. And so it seems to me they have a vested interest in not really believing it. So what are the reasons to believe it? Well, like Tom said, you know, there's those three possibilities. There certainly is evidence that certain people have intentionally fulfilled the prophecy, which was your original question. Pius XII, who was the Pope during World War II, the one that signed the concordat with Adolf Hitler. You know, there's the book that's out called Hitler's Pope by John Cromwell about him that's been very controversial. And, you know, of course, Benedict is trying to make him a saint, and a lot of Jews are giving some considerable pushback on that because of his role with Adolf Hitler. But what's very interesting, you know, in regard to your question, is right during the time of World War II, when the Vatican was getting information about the Holocaust and all this going on, he financed and produced a film based on the motto that the Malachi prophecy gave him. It was Pastor Angelicus, okay, in Latin, which just means angelic shepherd. And he actually had a documentary made about himself and titled it that, promoting the idea that he was the fulfillment of the Malachi prophecy. So here you have one example of a pope that explicitly went out of his way to claim that motto and, you know, and made a propaganda film about himself with the Malachi phrase as the title of the film. Now, that's a real obvious example of someone claiming it. But, you know, if the whole thing was that sort of fulfillment, I wouldn't even be interested in it. But the one that really caught my attention when I was investigating the prophecy is Benedict XV. And here we have the Pope. His motto was Religio Depopulata. Okay. And in English, that simply means religion depopulated. Okay. Now, like Tom said, we have a copy in print that no one even disputes that is printed in 1595. Okay, so you go up the sequence of popes, and this motto, religion depopulata, obviously that describes events going on during his pontificate. It can't really describe the pope himself. So as Tom said, the ones that, you know, post 1595 that we don't think are manipulated at all, they have a different character about them. And a lot of times they aren't specifically just about the Pope, but they're about events that happen during his reign. And so, you know, what happened during the reign of Benedict the 15th, you know, with religion depopulated? This is September of 1914 to January of 1922 was the time of his reign. This is right when World War II happened. Of course, World War II is devastating to the Catholic Church. It's right there in Europe. You have all these Italians involved. You have Mussolini in office. And to add insult to injury, you know, this is right at the time when we had the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. So you have like 200 million Russians leaving the Russian Orthodox Church to join the Communist Party. And then the ones that didn't join were severely persecuted. And you know, you have Stalin himself probably responsible for the death of 43 million people. And he targeted religious leaders and, you know, strong Christians because they're the kind of people that would stand up to the communist atheist agenda. So religion was very heavily depopulated, probably the most in world history ever, right at the time that this prophecy placed it. Now, that's the kind of fulfillment that does make the hairs on your arms stand up. And it's just not the sort of thing that you can say is a mere coincidence. It's a very falsifiable prediction. I mean, if the Catholic Church had grown or stayed the same, you know, then religion depopulated would have made no sense. And you know, you just have this completely vague and, you know, unproductive prophecy. But, I mean, that prophecy, that specific one was the one that really caught my attention. And I think it demands attention.
Well, and let me add to that, Chris. You mentioned Pius XII acting to fulfill the prophecy of the popes. Again, this illustrates that despite what some Catholics in, you know, over the last 50 years have said, cardinals over time have believed and have held the prophecy of the popes in high esteem. Also, the Siri thesis that Malachi Martin wrote about illustrates how important, how highly esteemed the prophecy of the popes was held. And if you don't know, if your listeners don't know about the Siri thesis, that involved the whispered evidence that Cardinal Giuseppe Siri of Genoa had actually received the majority of vote in both the 1958 and the 1963 conclaves, but under mysterious pressure, presumably from Masonic influences, he refused the papal office. And when he was asked 20 years later if in both of those conclaves he had been initially elected as pontiff, Siri responded, quote, "I am bound by the secret. The secret is horrible. I have books to write about the different conclaves. Very serious things have taken place, but I can say nothing," end quote. But, of course, Malachi Martin wasn't so silent. I was listening to him on a recording just before I came onto this show. He claimed to be an eyewitness of the 1963 conclave, and in his book, The Keys of This Blood, he said that Siri was, in fact, elected pope in both 1958 and 1963, but that his election was set aside because of interference by an emissary of an internationally based organization. He was talking about the Freemasons. But given that our book, Petrus Romanus, The Final Pope Is Here, is based in part on the prophecy attributed to St. Malachy called the Prophecy of the Popes, we'd be remiss not to also point out again how, in 1958, the inevitability of Siri's election was believed so strongly that in Italy, the prophecy of the popes, the prophecy ascribed to St. Malachy, describing Pius's successor as shepherd and sailor. That's number 107 in the Prophecy of the Popes, Pastor et Nata, was commonly illustrated, attributed, I should say, to Siri. The maritime city that had been his lifelong home where he was born, the son of a dock worker, was thought to be connected to the Prophecy of the Popes. In fact, that was the most important seaport in that country. It was the birthplace of Christopher Columbus, and a Genoa newspaper at the time wrote, quote, "No one better than Siri could symbolize this motto from the prophecy of St. Malachy. He is a pastor of highest virtues, a captain of the ship, born and raised on the sea," end quote. So, again, down through time, regardless of what some Jesuits may have said in terms of this information, this prophecy has been highly esteemed by members of the cardinals and, in some cases, those who elect who the Pope is going to be. And then, of course, for the audience, the tour de force to that fact is actually the book by René Thibault that Chris came across. And I'll let Chris talk about that, because as far as I'm concerned, that is probably, that's the price of the ticket. If you buy the book, Petrus Romanus, The Final Pope Is Here, it is the chapter and the research that Chris did that led to the discovery of the work by the Catholic educator and academic and Jesuit, René Thibault.
Chris? Well,
certainly. Go ahead.
No, I'm, go ahead.
Okay. Well, yeah, I can talk about René Thibault. What, you know, what I was doing at the beginning of the research was reading the criticisms by the Jesuits. I read several, Thurston, O'Brien, and they're mentioned in the books. And there's a lot of books written about this prophecy. It's kind of interesting if, as was some of the Jesuits claimed, and it was such an obvious forgery, it's amazing to me that you can find 20 or 30 books written by them about it. But one of these Jesuits that wrote a book about it is this guy, René Thibault, and he's a Belgian, born at the late 19th century and lived in the 20th century. And he was a university professor, like Tom said, and he wrote books about theology and about the Bible. His last book was called The Mysterious Prophecy of the Popes, and it was published in 1951. And that's really important to recognize. This book is over 60 years old, and I had to go and get it dug up from the basement of a local university. It had been in cold storage, you know, with dust all over it. Nobody's looked at this thing in ages. And he emphatically believed that the prophecy of the popes was a real prophecy. Now, some of the ideas that Tom's talked about and that we have in the book about there being layers of context, you know, that a part of the prophecy that was altered and is probably a forgery, he talks about that extensively. So I learned a lot of that information by studying his work. Now, I had to translate it from French, but the thing that Tom's talking about that really just made this project explode for us is that here we have in 1951 this Belgian Jesuit saying that the year of the final pope is 2012. He didn't just say it once. He calculated it. He found all these encryption schemes and codes within the Latin text of this prophecy, and he found it from like six or seven different angles. Now, one of the most obvious and the most easiest to explain on the radio that I can tell you about is that he found that the authentic portion of the prophecy started around 1572, something like that. And so what he did is he counted all the popes from when he thought that the real part of the prophecy started up until his day, which was 1950, about when he was writing. And he just divided and then calculated the average number of years for the reign of a pope. And he found this to be 11 years. Okay, so from that date, from 1572 up until, there was 40 more popes. So he just multiplied 40 times 11 and got 440 years plus 1572 is 2012. Okay, so he guessed, based on this extrapolation of 11 years per pope, that in 1951, he wrote that the final pope will be in 2012. Well, what I did, well, I said, okay, 11 years, huh? So I'll just add all the new popes on since 1951 and then see if that average still holds. And it did. It held remarkably well. And, you know, in fact, if Benedict does retire this year, it'll almost be a perfect 11.0 in decimal numbers. I mean, I calculated it down to the 1/1000th place. And, you know, it could have been easily falsified here as well. If John Paul I, the one before the famous John Paul II, he was only a pope for 33 days. Now, imagine if he had had, a 20-year reign or, you know, even 10, 15 years. This 11-year average would have been thrown off, but it wasn't, and it's held true up until today. You know, so Is Rene Thibault, was he right in 1951 to predict the year 2012? Well, it looks like a strong possibility because, you know, the Benedict XVI that's in office now, even if it's not 2012, it's not going to be much longer just based on nature. I mean, he turned 85 this year. He's old. They're pushing him around in a car, like Tom said. I think that it's going to be true. And if that is the case, then what a discovery that we found in this Belgian Jesuit. I mean, long before the Mayan calendar, long before all these History Channel specials about 2012 and the blockbuster films coming out of Hollywood about 2012, back in 1951, we had this Jesuit predicting 2012 as this end times event horizon. That alone really amazed Tom and I, and we knew that we were onto something with this book project.
Isn't there a lot of infighting among the church? It seems like you brought that up in some interviews. And would this play in what's taking place? Does it tie in any with what, you know, some of this prophecy or not?
Yeah. Well, I didn't hear the last little part there because I had a problem with the phone. But what I will tell you is that you can look at news right now that's coming from very Catholic sensitive websites, the Vatican Observers, the Observatory, or whatever it's called, newspaper, Rome's owned newspaper, and even pro-Catholic news sites, and they are mystified over glimpses of activity right now at the Vatican that seems to indicate that there is a very serious internal struggle of some kind that they are trying to keep hidden from the outside world. Even the very pro-Catholic online newspaper Vatican Insider has a feature article up there right now talking about some of this information. And it seems to have something to do with the motive behind the moles and the poison pen letters that have been published recently. You might have saw news just this week where Benedict has set aside a special commission of retired cardinals, and he has given them the job of tracking down and finding out who is leaking information from the Vatican to the outside press. And not only do they intend on finding out who's doing it, they tend to internally prosecute those priests who are leaking this information because they're trying to keep a lid on it. Well, what are they trying to keep a lid on? What we know from the leaked information is that the cardinals are already preparing for the conclave that is going to elect Benedict's successor, a successor who also happens to be the final pope on the list of popes known as the Prophecy of the Popes, what tradition assigns to St. Malachy of Armagh in Ireland. Am I still on?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I heard a clicking sound. Well, anyway, a lot of these news reports, including those by pro-Vatican sources, are pointing to one personality in particular who seems to be at the center of the struggle, and that is Cardinal Tarcisio Pietro Peter Bertoni, who was born in Romanus. He is the Pope's Secretary of State. He is the Carmelingo who would administrate the duty of the Pope in the case of a vacancy of the papacy. He is a man about whom Pope Benedict has made decisions that indicate Bertoni is, or at least once was, and I think still is, his choice for successor. Both of these men at times have appeared to be stacking, massaging the red hats in Bertoni's favor for to be elected as Pope in the next conclave. For instance, Pope Benedict very much aligned the group type from which the next pope will come just this last January the 18th, when he officially installed 22 new cardinals in a consistory. Most of them were Europeans, primarily Italians, already holding key Vatican stations. And by elevating those advisors to the Sacred College of Cardinals, this German pope has certified that Europeans are now going to number over half of all cardinal electors, 67 out of 125, and a quarter of those voters in a conclave are going to be Italian. And so as a result, Benedict seems to be putting his definitive stamp on an Italian successor. In fact, he gave a I don't know if it was a homily or if it was just a theological statement. You know, he is also a theologian for the church. He is the church's Rottweiler, they call him. He made a theological statement here just a couple of weeks ago that the Pope is not only the international head or leader of the Roman Catholic Church, but he is also the pastor of a local church, talking about Rome. And therefore, he believed that the best choice in his successor would be an Italian, because he is also the pastor of the Roman Church. Well, now think about that. Here you have, and this is almost too good to be true, right? Cardinal Tarcisio Peter Bertone, who was born in Romano, Peter the Roman. I mean, that's almost too good to be true. And I would add that it doesn't have to be that good to still be a fulfillment of the prophecy, because first of all, the Pope doesn't have to be, he doesn't have to have a Christian name of Peter, because every Pope is, in a sense, the latest Peter in the line. He is the Pope that sits on the throne of Peter. So every Pope in that sense fills the shoes of what they believe to be their first Pope in their dogma, Saint Peter. Secondly, an Italian of any name would be a Roman, so an Italian Pope is all you have to do to fulfill this prophecy, to have Peter the Roman. But of course, Cardinal Tarcisio Peter Bertone, as an Italian, would very, very much fit. And I think, in my opinion, he is still the number one in the top ten. In our book, by the way, we provide the top ten possibilities to fulfill the prophecy of the Pope as Peter the Roman. He would still be my number one. Having said that, all of the papal contenders right now that are somehow involved in some kind of an internal struggle in the Vatican, where you have a little bit of infighting and poison pen letters and this side struggling against that side, and there are those who do not like Tarcisio Bertone. But what I would say is all those contenders might want to consider how a lot of even Catholics believe that the 16th century seer Nostradamus was actually the author of the prophecy of the popes. And if that is so, there is a point that was made by the National Catholic Reporter earlier this year concerning the popular West African cardinal Peter Turkson. He is an Igbo Nigerian. And he is a young man a young person in terms of electability. He's only 63, which is young for a pope. And all of that might have a way of coming back around, because Turkson could fulfill not just the prophecy of the popes, but also one of the quatrains in Nostradamus' predictions, when he made a prediction of a young black pope who seizes control of the Roman hierarchy in the end times with the assistance of conspirators, and that is from Quatrain 625, in which he wrote, quote, "Through Mars adverse," that is a time of war, "will be the monarchy of the great fisherman," that is the pope, "in trouble ruinous, a young black red," that is a young black cardinal, "will seize the hierarchy, the predators acting on a foggy day," end quote. So, again, though, it's almost a novelty for me to quote things like Nostradamus, because I think you can make Nostradamus say anything you want it to say, but I do believe that we have a confluence of events. We have a concatenation of events right now, and we can, if you want, we can talk about a lot of the other indicators that are pointing towards the year 2012 as a moment where we could witness the arrival of a false prophet of biblical fame, followed by the Antichrist, and the initiation of the Great Tribulation period.
Well, please do. Tom, please do.
Yeah, I could do that. And then it also dawned on me, I could also talk about not just ancients, but some modern Catholics who also believe in this prophecy, and who believe that the very next pope, following Pope Benedict, is going to be the pope who will reign during the Great Tribulation period. There are even modern Catholics who also believe that to be true. But since I mentioned 2012, and I don't want to hog the show here from Chris Putnam, so I'll say these things about 2012. In our book, we talk about this confluence. What we called strange 2012 attractors or something like that, that seem to also have pointed towards the current time, the current year, as a matter of fact, as an exact target that would see the fulfillment of end times biblical prophecy. So think about this. First of all, we've been talking about a medieval prophecy, a Catholic prophecy, that points to the coming of the false prophet. Contemporaneous to that is a prophecy from what is widely considered to be the most important work of Jewish Kabbalah, magic, and that is the Zohar, which is a collection of books that were written in medieval Aramaic about 700 years ago that mostly contain commentary on the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, the books of Moses, the Torah. But in addition to interpreting the scripture, there's a section in the Zohar called the Be'era section. For those that want to look it up, it's volume 3, section 34. And there's a subsection there called the signs heralding Mashiach, or the coming of the Messiah. Now, why is this important? Because you have a 700-year-old Jewish prophecy in the Zohar that set the date for when they believed their Messiah would appear. And lo and behold, 700 years ago, they saw his coming in the Jewish calendar year 5773, which in our Gregorian calendar is the year 2012. Specifically, they saw him, they set the date in September, the new moon of this year, 2012, and extending over into the following year, 2013. And as I've pointed out elsewhere, you have to keep in mind that Christians would see this actually as a prophecy about the coming of the Messiah, the coming of the Antichrist, excuse me, because the Orthodox Jews rejected Jesus as their Messiah. And we know, according to the New Testament, that therefore they are going to accept someone in his place, a false Messiah, who's also known as the Antichrist. So you have a 900-year-old Catholic prophecy that foresaw the coming of the false prophet that looks to play out in the year 2012. You have a 700-year-old Jewish prophecy that set the very date of 2012 for the coming of their Messiah. And then, so you have the false Messiah, the Antichrist, predicted in a 700-year-old Jewish prophecy to appear in the year 2012. Similarly, you have a 900-year-old Catholic prophecy of the popes that looks to be unfolding in parallel fashion to provide Petrus Romanus in 2012. Also, and I don't have the information on this yet, but Jewish rabbis in Jerusalem, I saw a news report the other day where they're getting ready to publish an article that says that the Torah has a secret code in it that points to the arrival of their Messiah in the year 2012, so that would be additional confirmation from them. And then you have what most people are aware of, you have the Mayan calendar that does roll over December 21st of this year, 2012, with the predicted return of their flying dragon god Kukulcan. You have the Aztec calendar that ends in 2012 with the return of their flying dragon god Quetzalcoatl. By the way, if you study the ideas around the death, the cosmology around the death of Quetzalcoatl, he went down at death into the underworld where he joined Bolan Yaktiku, where he is now guarding the bones and the seed of the old ones who will rise December 21st, 2012, with the arrival of Bolan Yaktiku. And we have now two, not one. We did have one relief in Tortuguera, Mexico, Tabasco, Mexico, that spoke of the arrival of Bolan Yaktiku to rise from the underworld in the year 2012. Now we have two. And what's interesting, when you read the descriptions of the coming of Bolognac-Deku as he rises from the underworld, the nine support gods descend from the heavens very quickly, and it really honestly sounds very much like they're describing giant motherships of some kind that descend above the earth. Anyway, that's part of the cosmology of the Mesoamericans. Then you have the Cherokee Indian tribe, who 200 years ago here in America, during a whole series of apocalyptic prophecies, set their calendar to end in the year 2012 with the return of their flying dragon rattlesnake god. The Hindu Kali Yuga calendar ends in the year 2012 at the end of the age of the male demon. If you read my book, Apollyon Rising 2012, then you know that the prophecy that is upon the great seal of the United States of America, the Cum Sibyl's prophecy, the Novus Ordo Seclorum, is set to be fulfilled with the coming of the Antichrist in the year 2012. And then some stuff that might even be more intriguing to evangelicals and Catholics alike are, for instance, Jonathan Edwards. I'll let Chris tell you about that. But how Jonathan Edwards, 350 years ago, tied this time frame to the destruction of Rome and the possible appearance of the false prophet and the Antichrist. Right, Chris?
That's correct. A lot of the research into biblical prophecy and the Catholic Church that ended up in the book started with my study of church history in seminary. You have to take a whole sequence of church history classes, you know, starting at the first century with the apostles and Jesus, going all the way up until now. And, you know, having an interest in biblical prophecy, especially, you know, the prophecies in the book of Revelation and Daniel, I was really curious to see what great Christian thinkers have thought over the centuries. And, of course, you know, we have this whole upheaval at the Protestant Reformation. And, you know, without exception, all the reformers from Luther on thought that the Pope was the Antichrist. There's just volumes of material available making that claim. And it's quite interesting that in Protestantism today that a lot of that, a lot of people aren't even aware of that. But, I mean, 100 years ago, it wasn't even questioned. People like Charles Spurgeon, he had no doubt in his mind that the Pope was the Antichrist. I mean, it wasn't even a question. I mean, it was just an accepted fact. They literally believed that the Antichrist would reign for a period of 1,260 years. If you look in Revelation chapter 12, there's a prophecy about the woman, and the reformers all saw the woman as the church that was chased into the desert by the red dragon, being Satan, and that the period of 1,260 years was the time that the true church was persecuted by the Antichrist. So, you know, the question then becomes is where do you start the 1,260 years? And so there's different arguments about that. But what I discovered is that a lot of the reformers thought it was perhaps 606 A.D., based on the fact that that is when really you see the Bishop of Rome proclaiming his universal bishopship over everyone in the church. And see, you know, contrary to the way the Catholics present this, they kind of act like Peter was the first pope and that the whole idea of the papacy was in Christianity from the beginning. And that's just demonstrably not true. I dedicate some time in the book showing that Peter was really never a pope at all. And a lot of their mythology about him being buried in Rome and things like that are very questionable. But, I mean, you don't even have a true pope until around 600 A.D. It just didn't exist. The Bishop of Rome was simply a local leader. And, you know, Rome was the capital of the Roman Empire. So people did look to Rome for leadership. But it wasn't until around 606 A.D. that you get a pope proclaiming himself to be the universal leader of the church. So a lot of the reformers saw it as that. Now, something that I discovered that is quite interesting, and Roman Catholics, if you're listening to this, you should listen to your own leaders, because the pope that was before the universal bishop, Gregory the First. Now he lived. He was the pope, you know, from 540 in the 600s, 604. He was the last one before this event happened. Now he wrote this. Okay, Gregory the First, Bishop of Rome, wrote. I'm going to quote him here. Now, I confidently say that whosoever calls himself or desires to be called universal priest is in elation of the precursor of Antichrist, because he probably puts himself above all others. So here you have Gregory First, who's a saint in the Catholic Church, saying that if anyone claimed to be the universal bishop, that he would be the precursor to Antichrist. So you have your own leader saying that, and then the very next pope did that, okay? Now, in the book, I make an argument that, you know, if we were to perhaps accept the Reformers' interpretation, now, and I don't fully accept their interpretation of the book of Revelation and end times prophecy, but I still don't dismiss it either. And what I argue for in our book is kind of a hybrid interpretation where you can allow for elements of various views to be true simultaneously, because they're not necessarily contradictory. But I found that Jonathan Edwards and many of the other reformers kind of had a debate. Was the beginning of the reign of the papal Antichrist in 606, or was it when the Catholic Church actually became a temporal power, meaning that they took over, you know, land, and actually became a worldly political entity? Now, that happened in 756 A.D., and the thing that's really curious about it, it was all based on fraud. I make a case in the book, I mean, it's not really even disputed by Catholic historians anymore, that there was a document that was created out of whole cloth. It was called the Donation of Constantine. And what this document is, it's just an outright forgery. It claims that the head of the Roman Empire, the Pontificus Maximus, in 300 A.D., Constantine donated the empire to the Pope, okay, and gave him all this land around the city of Rome, which became the papal states. But okay, the document I'm talking about, the Donation of Constantine, is a complete forgery, and it's been demonstrated very thoroughly. But back in 756, no one knew that, and they didn't really have the scholarship that we have today to examine it. And Pope Stephen, in 756, took it to King Pepin, who was Charlemagne's father in France, and showed him this document and said, you know, I'm supposed to have all this land, and it's been taken over, you know, by the Lombards and all these other groups in Italy that had surrounded Rome. And so Pepin went to Italy with an army and just slaughtered a lot of people and just, you know, outright warfare based on a fraudulent document, and then, you know, took the land and gave it to the Pope. So you have the papacy achieving worldly power and becoming a political body at this time, you know, based on fraud. And and what it did to the Catholic Church is pretty horrendous. I mean, you know, I think that the Catholic Church was a Christian church, you know, up until you started getting all these corrupting influences. And this is just a prime example of what happened. Once you become a political body, you know, back in these days when you have kings and queens, you know, assassinating each other and all kinds of intrigue over royal lines, well, that came into the church in force once they became this power. And historians, I mean, even the historians at Notre Dame University, they use a term from the period like 800 to 1200, 1300. It's called the pornocracy. That's what they call, you know, these years of the papacy, because it was so debauched. You have all kinds of hedonism, occultism, necromancy, worshiping of demons, orgies. I mean, just horrendous immorality going on in the papacy. And we document some of that in the book in all of its gory detail. And it really shows that a corner was turned at this point in 756 when they became a worldly power and started issuing political control over people that they really lost any resemblance of Christ-likeness or interest in maintaining Christian virtue. It just completely went south. And, of course, it just continued to grow worse, and that's what Martin Luther was objecting to. That's what the kind of thing that that prompted the Protestant Reformation. Now, I don't really think that the Pope is the final end times Antichrist by any means. But in 1 John, the Apostle John did say, "Many Antichrists have come," meaning this was in the first century. So Antichrist is kind of a flexible term. It really means anyone that opposes Christ or puts himself up instead of Christ. And, one of the arguments that the Reformers used is that the Latin term vicar, it means instead of or in place of. Well, the Greek prefix ante means the same thing. It means in place of. So quite literally, the Pope's self-proclaimed title of vicar of Christ in Latin literally means Antichrist in Greek. It's almost a one-to-one translation, which is pretty disturbing in a lot of ways.
Yeah. But, and the thing that the point that I was making was that your research into Jonathan Edwards and how he considered that the most likely time for the end of the reign of Antichrist was 1260 years after that date, 756, the acceding of temporal power to the Pope, which would place then the Antichrist within the years of 2012 to 2016. And then another thing that we became aware of during this research, and this is the last illustration I'll give because I don't want to just get stuck on this one question of the year 2012, was how 130 years after Jonathan Edwards. And by the way, that's the work on Jonathan Edwards that Chris Putnam did is university level research material, and it is in the book, so that you'll be able to verify that neither myself nor Chris was making this up. And then, but what I was going to say is 130 years after Jonathan Edwards wrote what he did in 1878, you had William J. Reed, a pastor, and I guess, Chris, isn't his church still in the United States? Isn't it like a mega church today?
Yeah, it's a big, prominent Presbyterian church.
Yeah, big, prominent Presbyterian church, but he founded it, William J. Reed. But in 1878, he wrote in a book called Lectures on the Revelation concerning the papal system, he wrote that he was prepared to answer the question, if all of these statistics were correct, when would the papal system come to an end? And he said it would be destroyed in the year 2012. So the point that I was making was that you have Christians who for hundreds of years have looked forward to the year 2012 as the date when Rome could be destroyed, the false prophet and the Antichrist would appear. And then you have for thousands of years ancient occultic societies like the Maya. You have a 900-year-old Catholic prophecy, you have a 700-year-old Jewish prophecy. And by the way, the Maya, when their Chilambalam, the jaguar shaman, when he prophesied concerning the events surrounding this December 21st, 2012, he also saw it coupled with the appearance of two great, I think he referred to them as prophets, two great personalities. So what is he talking about? Is he talking about the two prophets that will prophesy in the streets of Jerusalem until they're slain, or is he talking about the coming of the false prophet and the Antichrist? What's very interesting is that an academic by the name of Richard Luxton made himself many years ago, long before any New Age popularity about the subject of the end of the Mayan calendar, he was an academic, made himself a friend of the Yucatec Maya. And over time, he earned their trust, and that's why they gave him permission to interpret into English the Book of the Kumayel, the council book of the Yucatec Maya that was written down about 500 years ago. And what's very interesting is in his margin notes, when talking about the final, what is called the Katun 13 Ehu, meaning the final 13 steps that end this December 21st, 2012, in the margin notes, he actually wrote how the Chilambalam, the jaguar shaman, who was a convert to Christianity under the Mexican invaders, how this Mayan prophet who converted to Christianity was coupling, according to Richard Luxton, was coupling the end of the 13-step countdown with what he called the Christian final judgment. Now, when I read that some years ago, what leaped off the pages at me was how Richard Luxton said that the beginning of this final 13-step countdown started in 1776 and would end in the year 2012 with the return of the god. Quetzalcoatl, the Mayan god, Kukulkan, how that dragon would return at that period of time. But what leaped off the pages at me was how all those numbers perfectly matched what was on the Great Seal of the United States of America, where you also have the year 1776, which was the start of the final 13-step countdown. You have 13 steps on an uncapped pyramid, over which is hovering the all-seeing eye of Horus, Apollo, Osiris. So that was what caused me to think that there was something uncanny. That's another show for another time. I want to tell people that the documents that Chris dug up and that I dug up, from René Thibault to what's happening in ancient cultures, if they buy this book, Petrus Romanus, The Prophecy of the Popes, if they buy that from Survivor Mall, they're giving away a DVD data library over there that literally has more than 20,000 pages of research material, entire libraries. It's got all the stuff from Jonathan Edwards. It's got the book Lectures on the Revelation by Reverend William J. Reed. It's got The Mysterious Prophecy of the Popes in French by René Thibault, and also a rough English translation by Chris. It's got 8 hours of radio shows. It's got movies. So it's a huge data library, and it's being given away absolutely free if they get the book Petrus Romanus from Survivor Mall. And the reason I'm saying that is because we want people to have the information and the history and the documents, the vast quantity of documents that we actually poured through when writing this book. That's why there's over 700 authoritative endnotes in this book, because we wanted to make sure in the publishing of this book that people wouldn't come back afterward and accuse us of some kind of sloppy or shoddy, research. Chris also mentioned how that the days of Spurgeon, that during that time there was a common belief among the reformers that the Pope was the Antichrist. What we also point out in this book that we maybe should talk about, and that may come as a surprise to some modern Catholics, is it wasn't just the reformers that believed that Rome would become the seat of the Antichrist in the end time. That was actually a common eschatology among high-level Catholic scholars as well, including celebrated theologians in the church like Cardinal Henry Manning, Bishop Salvatore Zola, Frederick William Hell, numerous who saw that in the last days this prophecy of the popes would be fulfilled, in the sense that demonically infested clergy at the highest levels in Rome would subvert and would use the papacy as a political vehicle for an occult world order. That's not just reformers talking. That was the belief of early Catholic scholars. In fact, even some of their most revered apparitions, Fatima, La Salette in France, that was favored by two popes, foresaw Rome becoming the seat of the Antichrist in the end time. And some of the modern Catholic writers, some, by the way, who are still alive and who hold high seats in Rome, believed that this pope, in the final conclave that Malachi Martin wrote about, this pope, the final one, the one following Benedict, would be a pope under the control of Satan. In fact, there are authorities in Rome right now that have openly discussed how there are very powerful Satanists at the highest level in Rome that are working towards this end. I'm talking about Jesuit priests who have published works and who have not been booted out of the church, have said that at the highest level of church hierarchy, there are cardinals in league with Satan working towards that moment in which Rome will become the seat of the Antichrist. That's something that a lot of modern Catholics are not aware of, and it is documented in this book.
Well, am I correct in what I was listening to on one of your interviews, that Rome will burn? Is that right? Again?
Yeah, where that comes from, first of all, you have the prophecy of the popes, and Chris read to you earlier the final line in the prophecy of the popes in which it says that Rome would be destroyed. Secondly, in the 700-year-old Jewish prophecy from the Zohar, it not only prophesies that their Messiah would arrive in the year 5773, which in our calendar is the year 2012, but they couple with that Rome will be destroyed by fiery objects falling from the sky. That's part of that Jewish prophecy. Now, you also have, again, some of the apparitions, like the apparition of Fatima, talks about the bishop dressed in white, talking about the Pope, and how he is seen crawling over the bodies of dead bishops and dead people's religious, trying to make his way in the great city to a cross when he also is killed. So you have a common theme among the Catholic prophecies that Rome would become apostate, that Rome would become the seat of the Antichrist, that Rome will give birth to a final pope who will work with the Antichrist, and that Rome will be destroyed. Now, what are these fiery objects that are falling from the sky that annihilate Rome during what sounds like a final conclave? Because in the Zohar, it says that all of the kings of the earth would be gathered in Rome at that time. Well, that sounds like a conclave, where you have the representatives from nations around the world gathered in Rome for the election of a pope, and that they, too, the ones that have not yet arrived there, are the only ones that are not destroyed. So it's at the beginning of a conclave, it sounds like, and something happens. Now, some believe that maybe this is meteors or the breakup of a meteor, and you have these fiery stones that are falling from the sky. There are others, including Catholic mystics, including modern Catholic mystics, that think it might be a terrorist attack on the city of Rome during a papal conclave. Keep in mind that when you look at the Islamic terrorists, they see themselves as enemies of Christianity. And in fact, in some of those countries right now, there's horrible persecution, Christians being beheaded, being imprisoned, that's happening. But when they think, when the Muslims think of Christianity, they think of Rome. They think of the Pope as the international head of Christianity. That's what they think about. That's how they identify it. So if a terrorist Muslim group wanted to attack Christianity, there would be no better place than for them at some time to plot some kind of an attack on the city of Rome. Now, here is what the man who is a Catholic, a modern Catholic mystic, who in 2002 correctly predicted that the Pope who would succeed John Paul II would be named Benedict XVI. He named him before it happened. This Catholic mystic's name is Ronald L. Conti, Jr. You can Google him, look up his website, and read his prophecies. He believes that the very next Pope is going to take the name Pius XIII. Now, he believes that because the name Pius is associated historically with popes that emphasized authoritative doctrine during their pontificates, and Conte interprets that as best fulfilling the implication in the prophecy of the popes, Peter the Roman, meaning a pope who's going to reaffirm the authority of the Roman pontiff over the church, authority that Conte says is based on the pope's place as a successor of Peter. That's according to their dogma. And that this pope's going to emphasize the supremacy of the Roman Catholic faith and the Roman Catholic Church over all other religions, all other denominations, and its authority over all Christians and all peoples of the world. But interestingly, Conte, if you read his prophecies, he adds something very important, because Conte is a believer in the prophecy of the popes. He believes that the next pope is Petrus Romanus and that Rome will be destroyed. And I'll quote what he says here. Quote, "During the reign of Pope Peter the Roman, the great apostasy begins, and this pope will mark the first part of the tribulation during our generation," end quote. Conte then goes on to envision that the biblical apocalypse is going to start this year, 2012, when, as he sees it, Benedict is assassinated. And you might recall late last year when a cardinal by the name of Romeo got involved in a little bit of an issue out of Rome, in that evidently Cardinal Romeo in China had met with some of his business partners and said that Pope Benedict XVI wouldn't live out the year 2012. Well, that was seen as I forget what the German word for it is, but it means a plot against the Pope, that some mafioso plan was unfolding. The Pope was going to be destroyed. That, by the way, those comments were taken seriously enough that the Vatican actually had them investigated and created a report on it, which the public has not been able to see. But so there has been some verification that there might be a plot to assassinate Benedict before the end of 2012. I don't know if that's what's going to happen or not. I'm telling you that that's part of what has been coming, what Rome's trying to keep a lid on. That's part of what's been said. Well, Conte believes that Benedict is going to be assassinated. He writes about it on his website. And then he's going to be replaced by Petrus Romanus, but he said that's going to be followed by a series of cascading events that's going to result in World War III, which is going to be triggered when an Iranian-backed terrorist group explodes a nuclear bomb in New York City, which then is going to give birth to the Great Tribulation period, and by July of 2013, Rome is destroyed when it is struck either by a nuclear missile or a bunch of missiles that are fired either during World War III and hit Rome by mistake, or a terrorist activity that sends these bombs landing into the Vatican City. So all of that to say, that's where you may be hearing some of these rumors about Rome being destroyed and Rome burning, in that there are very old prophecies that refer to the destruction of Rome. There's at least one Jewish prophecy that sees Rome destroyed when it is struck by fiery objects falling from the sky. And there's modern Catholics trying to interpret both the prophecy of the popes and these other ancient prophecies, and the Fatima and La Salette predictions, and putting it all together. And with Conte, you have a guy who has at least a somewhat proven record. He's been accurate on more than one occasion, and is a modern Catholic seer. And he sees that this year it all starts. Rome is attacked during a conclave. Benedict is assassinated. A new pope, Petrus Romanus, is voted in. The Great Tribulation begins. I mean, he has a lot of exact details, right, in his predictions. And, you know, time will tell whether he was correct or not. But anyway, that, to answer your question, that is where some of that speculation comes from.
Now, Chris, I believe it was you that got in a little bit into Jerusalem getting the church being moved to Jerusalem. Am I correct there?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of writings, especially coming from Jewish journalists, about the Catholic Church trying to acquire the Holy City, really trying to take a sovereignty of it, and which of course comes into play in biblical prophecy, and you know, just to complete, you know, one of Tom's thoughts. I mean, the one that the most obvious one, and the one the reformers saw, was that, you know, the parallel between Rome and Mystery Babylon in the Book of Revelation. You know, most scholars agree that the Book of Revelation has Rome in sight. I mean, it mentions this; it calls it the city on the seven hills. In Revelation chapter 17, it says, "And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth." Now, when the Apostle John wrote the Book of Revelation, the great city that had dominion was Rome. I mean, Rome, it was the Roman Empire. So there's just really no doubt that John had Rome in mind back in the first century before there was a Catholic Church. But, you know, isn't it interesting that, you know, this prophecy is projecting way into the future, of course, because, you know, the next chapter, Revelation chapter 18, is about the fall of Babylon, and it's about the destruction of this great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. So, I mean, it's in the Bible. And so when we hear all these extra biblical prophecies and all these ones from Catholic mystics and, you know, even this Malachi prophecy, which says the city on the seven hills will be destroyed and the dreadful judge will judge his people, you know, we're not just taking those in a vacuum. They coincide with what the Bible says, and I think that it's a demonstrable fact that Rome is in sight there, at least in part. I mean, I think that the mystery Babylon could be a conflation that also includes other apostate religions, other religions that are opposed to Christ. I mean, I could have room for all kinds of additions to it, but it seems to me that the capital of it is Rome. And if you look at, you know, recent Catholic theology, they've really adopted this very pluralistic theological stance where they're accepting Muslims, and they're kind of equating that these are all equal paths to God. They've really endorsed this with Vatican II. I mean, they almost talk out of both sides of their mouth, because you hear Pope Benedict in 2007 said that Protestant churches aren't real churches, you know, that they need to come under the thumb of Rome. But yet, at the same time, you have something like Vatican II, where you had John Paul II kissing the Quran, you know, in public and saying that, you know, that Islam was a valid way to God as well, which it just seems terribly incoherent to me, because, I mean, it just seems contradictory. But this is the kind of theology that they've been endorsing for the last 50 years or so. But, you know, interestingly, you know, just to get it a little bit more grounded back in biblical prophecy, you know, what we argue in the book is that this final pope is the false prophet. The false prophet's kind of the forgotten character of end times prophecy in a lot of ways. I mean, you hear a lot of talk about the Antichrist, but in Revelation chapter 13, it talks about the second beast. I'll read you just a little brief part of it. It says, "And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had horns like a lamb, and he spoke like a dragon. And he exercised all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast." So basically, the second beast, this character, has horns like a lamb. Now, in apocalyptic symbolism, that kind of tells us that, like a lamb, it sounds like he's viewed as a Christian leader, but speaks like a dragon. And the book of Revelation uncodes all these symbols for us, because it tells us that the red dragon is Satan. So, I mean, it's telling us right there that we have someone that appears like a lamb, but speaks like a dragon and causes everyone to worship the Antichrist. So, and that's who, in the book, we argue that that's the figure that we see as this final pope. And like Tom said...
Yeah, let me add to that, Chris, that, again, it isn't just the Reformers, and it isn't just Tom Horn or Chris Putnam, but again, the past authorities in Roman Catholicism also believed that the seven-hilled city and mystery Babylon was a reference to the Vatican. You mentioned a moment ago Revelation 17 and 18, 17, 18, and also verse 9, talking about the great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. Here's the mind that has wisdom, the seven heads or seven mountains or hills on which the woman sitteth. Well, the Roman Catholic Church continuously identified with themselves, with that city, up until just a few hundred years ago. In fact, even the most definitive Catholic encyclopedia since Vatican II declares, and I'm quoting here, "Hence, one understands the central place of Rome in the life of the Church today and the significance of the title Roman Catholic Church, the Church that is universal yet focused upon the ministry of the Bishop of Rome. Since the founding of the Church there by St. Peter, Rome has been the center of all Christendom," end quote. So they are totally identifying with that text. Then you have Catholic apologist Carl Keating, who admitted that Rome has long been known as Babylon. Keating claims that Peter's statement, "The church here in Babylon sends you her greeting," that's 1 Peter 5:13, proves that Peter was writing from Rome. And then he says this, quote, "Babylon is a code word for Rome. It is used that way six times in the last book of the Bible. Four of the six are in chapter 17 and 18. And in extra-biblical works such as the Sibylline Oracles, the Apocalypse of Baruch, and for Ezra, Eusebius, Pamphilus, writing around 303, noted that it is said that Peter's first epistle was composed at Rome itself, and that he himself indicates this, referring to the city figuratively as Babylon," end quote. So once again, one of the things that I think is very important in the research that we did was to try to be able to show to modern evangelicals the roots of the Reformation, and to modern Catholics that their own best thinkers, their greatest theologians, agreed with this premise in the early years. It really is only in modern history, since Vatican II, that there has been this ecumenicalism and this denial of their own most revered apparitions and prophecies, that these events are coming. And regardless of what you make of the prophecy of the popes, it doesn't matter if you reject it entirely. The next pope is the last one on that list, period. That's a fact. And if it happens to be a true prophecy, this Catholic prophecy says the next pope will be the false prophet who helps give rise to the Antichrist, and Rome is Babylon, which shall be destroyed, Mystery Babylon. So, again, all Chris and I are trying to do is awake both Catholics and modern evangelicals to what was believed by our Christian and Catholic forefathers regarding end times biblical prophecy.
Absolutely. You know, I was going to, there was another Jesuit. His name was Manuel Lacunza, and he wrote a book endorsing the futurist interpretation of the book of Revelation, and he explicitly saw Rome in those chapters of Revelation 17 and 18. And I'll just read you a few lines of what he wrote. This is a Jesuit priest from Chile, Manuel Lacunza. He writes, "Rome, not idolatrous, but Christian," meaning he's not talking about pagan Rome, he's talking about Christian Rome, "not the head of the Roman Empire, but the head of Christendom, and the center of unity of the true church of the living God, may very well, without ceasing from this dignity, at some time or other incur the guilt, and before God be held guilty of fornication with the kings of the earth, and amenable to all its consequences." So right here, you know, at the early 19th century, you have a Jesuit priest who sat down to interpret the end time prophecies, and he saw Rome, you know, in those prophecies and wrote about it explicitly.
Now, what makes it even more interesting is the testimony among highly placed church experts who are alive today, or some who are only recently deceased, who have asserted that Satan worship towards a particular end is real, and that it has occurred and is occurring inside the Leonine walls of the Holy See. That includes Monsignor Luigi Marinelli, whose 1999 book, Gone with the Wind in the Vatican, sold over 100,000 copies in the first 3 weeks, and he discusses Satanism being practiced by cardinals at the Vatican towards a particular end. Then you have exorcist and Archbishop Emmanuel Milango, in a speech at Our Lady of Fatima 2000 International Conference on World Peace, charging high-ranking members of the church hierarchy of being in league with Satan and working towards a particular end. And then, of course, you have the late Maverick professor of the Pontifical Biblical Institute, an eminent Catholic theologian by the name of Malachi Martin. And when the Manhattan Magazine, the Fatima Crusader, asked Martin about the public alarm that was raised in 2000 over Archbishop Milango's claim that high-ranking Vatican officials were followers of Satan, Martin replied, this was his reply, and it was published in the magazine, quote, "Anybody who is acquainted with the state of affairs in the Vatican in the last 35 years is well aware that the Prince of Darkness has had and continues to have his surrogates in the court of St. Peter in Rome, end quote. And listen, folks, 10 years before something pulled his feet out from under him while he was preparing for an exorcism, and Malachi Martin fell and then later died, and at that time was actually working on what he promised was going to be his most explosive book ever under the title Primacy, How the Institutional Roman Catholic Church Became a Creature of the New World Order. Martin had become very outspoken about Satanism at the heart of the Vatican throughout the College of Cardinals and all the way down to local parishes, which he said were in league with a secret diabolicus that began following the enthronement of the fallen archangel Lucifer. Malachi Martin went to his grave swearing that this enthronement of the fallen archangel Lucifer in the Roman Catholic Citadel on June 29, 1963 actually occurred. Other Catholic priests have backed him up on that statement, even to their own chagrin. Martin said that that horrible ritual, as he described it, had two primary objectives. Number one was to enthrone Lucifer as the prince over Rome, but the second was to assure that the sorcerous inception, the literal embodiment in flesh of that immaterial spirit, Lucifer, that it would fill the man who would ultimately become the final pope, Petrus Romanus, in a final conclave, which he actually wrote the book called The Final Conclave. And people can verify that for themselves in his book, The Keys of This Blood, his book, Windswept House. I was listening to a recording of him on the radio just a moment ago in which he was being asked, did this really, did this happen? And he verified, he swore on an oath, knowing that in his own dogma, he would be damning himself to an eternal hell if he was lying, especially given Catholic dogma, if he was criticizing the leaders of Rome, the Pope. And he swore on an oath that it was true, that it actually happened, the enthronement of the fallen archangel Lucifer being effected in the Roman Catholic Citadel, and that this was all being done to incarnate within a particular individual at that time who would later become Petrus Romanus. So it's going to be very interesting now to see what happens. You know, Chris, you know this, how in research for this book, we went not only from moldy corridors in those forgotten libraries in Europe and Yale, but we also went to the Sheriff's Department in Dane County, Wisconsin, investigating the murder of Malachi Martin's very good friend, Father Alfred Kunz, who was brutally murdered at his St. Michael Church, a Catholic church in Dane, Wisconsin. But he had been investigating the same Satanism among these priests that Malachi Martin had warned about, and he actually told Martin in the weeks just before his murder that he was afraid for his life. And, of course, when he was found dead with his throat slit, Malachi Martin, in various media, including with Art Bell on Coast to Coast, said that he had inside information that the Vatican Luciferians had murdered him because he was getting ready to blow the lid off this conspiracy. So, again, many modern Catholics, especially young Catholics, are probably completely unaware of how their own leaders, to whom they often invalue their soul and their eternity to, their own leaders warned, their own apparitions prophesied, their own theologians forecast this moment in which a pope, call him an anti-pope if you want to, call him an illegally elected pope, but a pope, a person, would take the seat of a St. Peter in Rome, and that pope will be under the influence of Satan. He will be the false prophet of end times biblical fame and will help give rise to the Antichrist.
Now, one of the things that I think I interpreted correctly is that when you started doing the research on this, that it reaches out far and wide to other societies and that they kind of support this sort of belief system. Am I right?
Well, as far as coons, what we did was there was what we found. I hired a private investigator that went to Dane County, tried to get investigative documents into what was going on with Father Coons. And at first, we were told that we were going to get those documents. Then we were told we weren't going to get them. And here's what part of this evolves around. There was a satanic animal sacrifice, and it is. And what's interesting is there's one that's described by Malachi Martin in Windswept House as part of the enthronement of the fallen Archangel Lucifer in the Vatican that seems eerily comparable to what was actually discovered in Dane County during the first hours of the murder investigation into Father Alfred Coons. And this includes a calf that had been found sacrificed on a farm near St. Michael's Church exactly 24 hours before Coons was last seen alive. And according to police reports that we were able to get our hands on, this calf's throat was slit, as was Father Coons, and its genitals were cut off. And there are details that we do not discuss in our book due to their horrific nature that have to do with how deep within occultism there are reasons for removing the genitals of a sacrifice that partly have to do with blasphemy of the Old Testament descriptions of animals being accounted unworthy as offerings to the Lord if their testicles are bruised or crushed or torn or cut. People can read that in Leviticus 22. But according to survivors of ritual satanic abuse, including Egyptian and Masonic Satanism. And I think this might be your reference about how there were others, mystery religions or the Illuminati. There were others who were involved in this conspiracy, such as Malachi Martin also wrote about. But in Egyptian Masonic Satanism, human sacrificial victims are sometimes laid on a table, and their genitals are removed in order to make them unworthy or unfit for salvation. Although there are versions of that type of human sacrifice and abuse, like in South Africa, that are called Muti murders, and actually people will pay very large sums of money for the genitalia from those human sacrifices in the belief that it'll bring them fertility and health and good fortune and all that. So we're talking about very, very deep and dark stuff here that we did not want in the book. And then, of course, there's just the ancient idea that decapitated people cannot partake in the resurrection. So very dark rituals can include mutilation of the head, the throat, the genitals, where damnation of the victim is meant as a magical curse. And in the case of the Dane County murder, we raised the question, was there a black ritual performed between the hours of 10 p.m. March the 2nd and 4 a.m. March 3, 1998, in order to target Father Coons, in order to mark him satanically, ritualistically, as unfit for redemption. And so during the investigation for our book, we made formal requests of the Dane County Sheriff's Office for pertinent case files. I think we might even list the case file numbers in the book. We certainly provide a photocopy of one of the letters from Dane County to us. All of this pertaining to this ongoing investigation of the Father Coons homicide. And after we were first told that we would be given all of the records, on December 15th, 2011, so 6 months or so ago, we got a letter from the office of Lieutenant Mark Twombly that was signed by Sheriff Mahoney that the district attorney would have to approve the release of the files, or in other words, it would take a court order, and therefore the request had been denied. So we went back and filed a second request for less delicate documents, which we were able to obtain, but none of those provided the solid clue to the larger question that we were seeking, and that related to the murder of Father Coon specifically. Was evidence collected at the crime scene that his murder was one of two things, either connected to his, or both, by the way, connected to his conservative position on Vatican II, and we pretty much know that that's the case, but more specifically, was information discovered, recovered from the crime scene, having to do with priests that were devoted to Satan, that had earned Father Kuhn's fierce enemies from within the church, because that's what Malachi Martin said, and that this reached all the way to the Catholic hierarchy in Rome, involved in ceremonies or behavior related to the enthronement of Lucifer and a ritual that had been conducted for the purposes of transmigrating the spirit into Petrus Romanus. That was where our investigation went with that. We received some information that might be the case.
Yeah, you know, Tom, at the beginning of the project, I looked into that too, because, like you said, those references by Malachi Martin about the enthronement of the Archangel Lucifer in the Vatican, it had a parallel ceremony going on in Charleston, South Carolina. And the way Martin described that was that you couldn't have the ritual violation of a young lady and all these things that they do in the satanic ritual in the Vatican specifically. So they actually had a parallel ceremony, and then they had a phone call and with a connection over to the Vatican. So they're actually acting out all the gory details of what they do in a place in South Carolina at simultaneously while things were going on in the Vatican. And, you know, it's interesting how they do that. But the thing that I dug into a little bit that was particularly disturbing, I mean, these all come from Catholic sources. This isn't like, you know, somebody just trying to smear the Catholic Church. But, you know, this whole thing with the pedophile scandal in the Catholic Church, I mean, it's been all over the news. In Ireland right now, it's a huge controversy. In Amsterdam and in Holland, they discovered 20,000 new cases came out this summer. I mean, they didn't all just happen this summer, but they got reported. They just now came to light. 20,000 cases of pedophilia from the Catholic Church just in Holland. And these things are, it's an institutional problem. It's a huge problem. But what Malachi Martin said, that this is not just a case of perversion, that these people are ritually, satanically engaging in pedophilia. It actually has a spiritual component to it that's more than just mere lust. And there was a book that I read in researching for this project that I didn't talk a whole lot about it, but it's a book by William H. Kennedy, and it's called Lucifer's Lodge. I'm not even sure if it's even in print, but he actually worked with Malachi Martin, and he uncovered all kinds of cases of Catholic priests that were, you know, accused pedophiles. And these are some of the guys that were protected by Rome and moved around. But they admittedly, this was not just a sexual predatory thing. This was actually part of ritual satanic worship. And it had little to do with just being perverts. These guys.
Right. Well, actually, that parallel ceremony that you were talking about that was conducted here in Charleston, South Carolina. And Malachi said the reason that location was selected was obvious, of course, because South Carolina is the mother lodge of the world. It's where you get the seat of the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite Freemasonry.
Right. Albert Pike.
But Albert Pike, who was the Grand Commander, he was known as a Satanist in his adopted state of Arkansas, and he loved to sit naked in the woods astride this phallic throne. And he would participate for days in drunkenness and debauchery. So what you're talking about is very much a pattern of pedophilism and other types of sexual debauchery that is intended for the purposes of generating a kind of esoteric energy.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I would just say people to look in the media right now, and it's no accident. I mean, we don't really have to just make these assertions, you know, out of thin air. 20,000 cases in Holland right now. Look at what's going on in Ireland right now. I mean, the church is in an uproar. I mean, the fact that there's a huge problem in Roman Catholicism is obvious if you just look at the media. And then, you know, for me, when you look at the book of Revelation, it talks about fornication. You know, that this mystery Babylon is a great harlot that create. I mean, the imagery, it just seems terribly coherent with what we see going on.
And then take that imagery to the layout of both Washington, D.C., and also the Vatican, where at the Vatican you have a 330-ton obelisk. What is the obelisk? It is the phallic symbol of Osiris. These are all symbols that are used for sexual, magical energy for the purposes of incarnating the resurrection of that great man of sin. That's the history behind all of it. So you have not just what's happening. What these renegade priests, what these fake Catholics, according to the Catholics, like Malachi Martin would have called them, what they are doing is perfectly in keeping with both the mystical orders and the symbolism, the design, the layout of these great cities, Washington and Rome, where you have a dome facing an obelisk, which all of us know dates back to the ritual sexual magic that was employed in ancient Egypt, including at places like at Karnak, for the purpose of drawing up from out of the underworld through the testes or the base of the obelisk and emitting that seed magically into the dome or the womb of Isis for the purpose of incarnating this demon seed, this demon god. Anybody that reads our book will know that. Anybody that reads Apollyon Rising 2012 will know that. These are facts that are not disputable. That's where the history comes from. In fact, the obelisk in St. Peter's Square was cut from a single block of red granite during the 5th dynasty of Egypt to stand as Osiris's erect phallus at the Temple of the Sun in ancient Heliopolis. So that's exactly where these symbols came from, and it fits perfectly with the ritual sexual magic that's being conducted by these pedophile priests.
Wow. Gentlemen, this has been quite an interview, and you've uncovered a lot of information to think about. And if we want to just go ahead and give your websites again and where they can get, you know, your book. And, you know, I want to really thank you for a great interview.
Well, so. The book, you should order that from www.prophecyofthepopes.com, because if you order it from there, you get the data DVD that Tom mentioned with just, it has a lot of the original source material that we used in researching the book. So you don't have to just take our word for it. You can actually go to the original sources and read what they say for yourself. So we wanted to give that to everyone. So that's www.prophecyofthepopes.com. My website, and you know, my calling has been biblical apologetics as well as other things. So I have a range of topics, but I've blogged a lot on these topics recently. My website is logosapologia.org. That's logosapologia.org. That's Chris Putnam. Thank you.
Okay, and Tom?
Yeah, great to be on with you, Melody and Chris. Of course, my website is the Raiders News, RaidersNewsUpdate.com. Or they can just go prophecyofthepopes.com. Great to be on your show today. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Melody.
Bye.